Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
And welcome to the Carol the Coach Show. Hey, this is a show about sexual addiction, and tonight I am really excited because we're going to be talking about, in the world of sexual addiction, what is exciting, healthy sex? You know, and obviously, true sexuality not only affects the sexual organs, but it affects the brain, and it's relational. And it operates from the premise that only through an intimate connection to each other can you experience highly erotic, spiritual, relational sex. But unfortunately, what we know to be true is that, you know, sex is such an intimate experience that most people that have been in addictions, They worry so much about how can they have good, healthy sex again. And so tonight I'm really excited to be talking to Alex Katahakis, who works with people on healthy sexuality. She is the clinical director for the Center for Healthy Sex. And I got to see Alex present at a workshop with Patrick Carnes, the whole ITEP certification program that certifies actual sexual addiction therapists. And we just did that in the spring, and she was wonderful. And so I reached out to our community and asked people who would like to talk about their expertise. And, of course, Alex responded and said, yes, I'd like to help people learn about healthy sex and what the difference is between healthy sex, intimate sex, erotic sex, and sex as a spiritual act, you know. And this is a big problem for people who are experiencing recovery from sexual addiction, because so oftentimes when there is an addiction, part of the program is not having sex and not masturbating. And if you're not in a relationship, not getting into a relationship. And if you are in a relationship, asking your partner to be patient and walking with you through the steps that will help to keep you in recovery and to keep you focused on what you need to do to stay sober, to stay recovered. And I work with a lot of sexual addicts who actually experience sexual anorexia. And that is a term whereby sex addicts in recovery are afraid to have sex. They're afraid to have sex because it might trigger sexual acting out. They're afraid to have sex because they don't know how to have true intimate relational sex. And the reason that is because very clearly, they haven't been relational for a long time. They have trained their brain to think of sex in one certain way. Maybe that's through internet porn. Maybe that's through prostitution. Maybe that's through voyeurism or exhibitionism. You know, there's just a variety of ways that they have trained the brain to think about sex. And so to be with their loved one, male or female, and to experience soulful sex, eye-open sex, that's not a turn-on any longer. And so they really have to get back in touch with what is relational sex and how do you do it and how do you talk yourself into believing that sex is so much more about connection. And I say talk yourself into it because initially it doesn't feel natural. Sex with a sex partner, when you're really holding each other and spending time with each other and gazing into each other's eyes and thinking about what you love about that person, doesn't feel natural because sex really means what's the high. What have you trained yourself to believe? What is sex like? And so in this interview, we're going to be talking about sex as an essential part of sexual sobriety, personal growth, and of course, personal development. So many of the clinicians that I have worked with and that Alex has worked with, as well as the patients, will ask, how do I restore my sexuality as self-care and a connection to another? And do I dare have sexual fantasies? You know, that is a type of sex, sexual fantasies. And what do those sexual fantasies look like? And do they have a place in my relationship? So we're going to be talking about that, too. This is going to be an exciting show. You're going to find out what are some of the recommendations for masturbation and exciting sex. And you know, as if this isn't a problem for all human beings, how do you talk to your partner about what you like sexually? And so, you know, I would encourage anybody to really listen to this show because they will probably be able to apply it to their own lives, even if they're not addicts. But for the partner of an addict, as well as for sex addicts as well, it's gonna be informative. And you can feel free to give us a call. So get out the piece of paper or get out your phone and write down this number because this is always going to be your call-in number if you have questions. And that is 646-595-3284. You can ask us about anything. We really appreciate your participation in the show. So, you know, you might be asking yourself, what is healthy sex? No doubt that the addiction has skewed your perceptions of sexuality, intimacy, and commitment. And let's face it, most sex addicts come from a family of origin where there may have been abuse, where there may have been enmeshment, but more than likely there was a disengagement and a lot of rigid roles. You probably didn't get your needs met if you're a sex addict. And in part, that was because of your family situation. Now, we know that not every situation is alike. And really, this is kind of a new field. Sexual health is absolutely a great field to look into. And so Alex will have some books that she can recommend on sexual health, and we are going to be interviewing in the future The Couple's Guide to Intimacy by Burke Hall. And so, you know, this is the place to go to find out, I want to say, not what normal looks like, but what normal can be like for you, because we all know that that's customized based on your needs, because there is no one right answer. And we do know that there's more of a growing understanding of what addiction's like and how it affects clients, and that there are some healthy guidelines and boundaries. As a matter of fact, if any of you have ever gotten the recovery task program, you know, that is where Patrick Carnes has put together that 40 and 90 day recovery task model. You will find that there is a CD on sexual health as well as some exercises that you can do accordingly. So oftentimes, you know, you can look at positive sexual health as a variety of dimensions. You know, we're looking at nurturing. Are you able to receive self-care, both do you give it to yourself, and do you allow your partner to give it to you? And that might just be being caressed, or taking a bath with your loved one, or taking a bath by yourself with candlelight, or having your feet massaged. And then we look at self-image. Do you have a healthy self-image about your body, about your sexual self? Do you reframe things? You know, as we get older, and I know that there are plenty of listeners on the show from ages 18 on up, but as people get older, their bodies change. That means their functioning changes. And are you able to go with the flow? Are you able to understand and appreciate exactly where your body's headed? You know, do you understand there's some wrinkles and the skin isn't as tight and maybe you're not as muscular? Do you accept that, you know, you may have a tummy or you may be 10, 15, 20 pounds overweight? And do you look at yourself as round and curvaceous, if you're a woman, as opposed to fat and sassy? Are you doing reading about sexuality? Is there a solid knowledge base about sex in general? Or has that been a taboo both in your family of origin and with your wife, husband, boyfriend, girlfriend? And do you need to maybe get into some healthy books that will remind you about erotic touch? Spirituality, I mean, are you able to connect your sexual desire and expression to the value and meaning of your own life? Are you able to say, you know, I deserve this. I deserve a healthy sexual relationship. I haven't had one. I've come from a lot of dysfunction, and I've really turned that around, and I have worked really hard on myself, and healthy sexuality will make me feel better. Do you know what passion is? Can you relive that? I mean, I get so many people that say, you know, I don't feel passion. My sex used to be a sex of following that euphoric recall, finding the high. And so I don't really know what it's like to totally engulf myself in somebody, trust them emphatically, share everything about myself, and I don't know how to be that vulnerable. So again, Alex is going to be helping us to understand, you know, about monogamous relationships and how does healthy sexuality begin. And, you know, we always talk about emotional maturity on this show, because that's what we all strive for, is to become more and more emotionally mature. That means taking risks, setting boundaries, learning assertiveness, talking about emotions. Well, she's going to be talking about erotic intelligence, and what does that mean? So as you can see, there's going to be some really great information shared on this show. And again, we want you to be part of the dialogue, and that number will be 646-595-3284. So when you really look at the qualities of positive sexual focus, you know, it's not just understanding what it is that you need to do, but it's actually practicing these skills one by one. And Patrick Carnes believes that you need to chart what you're doing so that you can actually monitor that. You know how it is. We can all get lazy, and when we write down, if we're wanting to lose weight and we write down what we eat, we're more likely to follow a healthy food plan. And if you write down how you've worked out at the gym and you chart that over time, you're more likely to get into the routine of practicing some of this stuff. Well, it is the same thing with sexual health. So not only does Dr. Carnes promote an abstinence list, which means defining behaviors that you need to abstain from, but he also suggests that you chart your healthy sexual behaviors. And when you do that, you're more likely to keep working on your sexuality, on yourself, and you're more likely to receive satisfying sex as a result. So it's all about healthy sexual focus. If you have specific questions, you can feel free to always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And check out my website, www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com. So appreciate that you all listen. This is obviously a niche that a lot of people need some help with, and they don't know where to turn. So keep spreading the word that this is a show where you can get all of your questions answered, as well as get the education you need from week to week when we interview the experts. So, Alex, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show. How are you doing this evening?
I'm fine. Thank you, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited about this topic because we've been talking for several weeks about sexual addiction and sexual recovery, and we probably haven't focused enough on good old healthy sex. And so you maintain that it's relational and operates from a premise of intimate connection with one another. Can you share what is erotic intelligence? That was such an interesting term.
Well, the term, the word erotic, by definition, means, the deliberate seeking of pleasure for pleasure's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And the word intelligence, in part, means with the skilled use of reason. So when you're seeking high levels of eroticism, when you're seeking pleasure, and you're doing it in a way where you're reasonable, then in theory, you're creating an optimum scenario for yourself. Sex addicts seek eroticism, but they're not using skilled reason at all. In fact, oftentimes when they're in their addiction, all reasoning goes out the window, and they're being driven by more primitive places in their brain and in their bodies, and they'll make profoundly and colossally unsound decisions and mistakes.
And so erotic intelligence would mean healthy ways of seeking pleasure for pleasure's sake. But I would assume that you could have erotic intelligence in a relational capacity in a monogamous relationship.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that would be, one of the ideals, that you don't have to seek. I mean, you can have erotic intelligence in a committed relationship. You can also have it as a single person. In a committed relationship, presumably you're in contact with your partner about what you do and don't like sexually, what you do and don't want to try, your fears, your concerns, your vulnerabilities, all of those things, because that's what leads to high levels of eroticism is intimacy.
Yeah, and I think for the partner of the recovering sex addict, that's always a scary place because people can feel objectified when the recovered sex addict reports, boy, this is what I'd really like. So how do you help a couple in that situation when the partner's worried about being objectified?
Well, that's a long, long road, because in a healthy sexual relationship, you are objectifying your partner. You're able to hold them in the light of someone that you love and cherish and whose back you have and who you would never betray and cheat on, while at the same time seeing them as a sex object that you are aroused by.
Mm-hmm.
And when those things get split, which is what happens, or compartmentalized with sex addicts, that's when it becomes problematic, because the objectification is devoid of the human being involved. So when you have a couple whereby there's been gross betrayal, and you have a female typically, or a partner who's feeling horrible about themselves and disgusted by the person who's betrayed them, it's highly unlikely you're going to move towards sex anytime soon. So with a lot of repair work, a lot of psychological repair work, a lot of boundary setting, and a lot of time, people can start to move towards these more sexual practices and eroticism, whereby they both feel confident and who they are and what they mean to each other. And part of that, again, goes back to having these difficult, sometimes grueling, long conversations about what's happened in the past around the betrayal and where the couple wants to go from the present day.
Yeah, that would totally make sense. And, of course, I and I'm sure you do too, when I'm working with a couple, they want to know, well, when can we work on that? And there is no time frame, you know, because obviously there's so much work that needs to occur prior to getting to that kind of erotic sexual relationship. Do you have any boundaries or recommendations for people when they are just getting into recovery? When they're, and yet they're wanting to jump the gun and figure out healthy sexual behavior.
Well, I think there's a distinction, or I'm making a distinction in my book, Erotic Intelligence, between healthy sex versus erotic sex. They're almost like developmental stages where people are reintroducing themselves to one another. And so early on, many, many times partners are sexual with the sex addict after they've discovered whatever's been going on, whether it's been a long-term affair or prostitution or you name it, and they do it because it feels good, they've felt lonely, they've felt undesired, and it's really a very painful trap because they often do not know the full extent and breadth of the sex addicts acting out sexually. So my best advice is not to jump the gun at being sexual just to make yourself feel better or to try and save your marriage. That's a hornet's nest, and it ends up making people feel worse about themselves, not better. So restraint, abstinence, a period of celibacy is almost always recommended for couples. And because everybody's so different and this problem shows up so differently in different people's lives, it's difficult to say that there's just one way to do this, because then that becomes a rigid way of thinking about things. But once a couple has been in recovery and they've gone through the disclosure process, meaning that the addict has done a significant amount of work on their sexual timeline history, they feel convinced and clear that they've been honest in disclosing all of their past behaviors, and that usually means they've been in a recovery program for a good 3 months before they can even make that proclamation. And then the partner hears the disclosure and feels in his or her gut that it's actually the truth. They don't feel like their partner, the addict, is still withholding from them. Mm-hmm. Then people can start to move towards a healthy sexuality with each other. And sometimes just the act of getting through that disclosure process, which can be harrowing, brings people closer together, and they actually feel more love for each other oftentimes than they felt in a very long time, because they've actually been honest with each other.
Well, yes, and it's definitely the establishment of further trust in the relationship which makes for good sex and probably erotic sex also.
Sure.
Now you are writing this book, and what made you decide that that was the topic that you wanted to explore further?
Well, I started working with sex addicts and their partners in 1998, and at that time, we were really just getting people sexually sober. And I was working with men predominantly who were coming back from meetings saying, God, you know, I'm looking around this room and everybody's sober, but everybody's afraid to have sex again. Mm-hmm. And I would hear this over and over and over again. And I realized that real recovery from sex addiction is about complete sexual health and sexual eroticism over time, because who would want to get healthy from sexual bad behavior if the opposite of that or the definition of health was either abstinence or boring sex? And so what I started to see that people really do have the capacity for health. The human organism wants to move towards healing, and part of healing is restoring and healing our sexuality. And many, many people's sexuality has been violated in some way or another, whether it was through literal physical sexual abuse or emotional abuse or shaming or extreme levels of religiosity. But somewhere along the way, people can have their sexuality damaged. And so I wanted to look at what the trajectory was from problematic sex to healthy, really spiritually evolved sexuality, and bring that to the population that was recovering from sex addiction.
So it was at that point that you decided to interview people or do the research yourself? Or
no, I had been teaching classes on healthy sexuality since 2000. and really exploring the question of what comprised healthy sex. So I had done a tremendous amount of reading. I was teaching about it. I was listening to the sex addicts I was treating, and I was paying very close attention to the conversations in the group therapies that I was running. And it was really through my interaction with people in recovery that I started to create a template for what this journey looked like.
Well, that makes total sense. Now, again, what's the difference between healthy and unhealthy or addictive sex?
Well, healthy sex is generally relational. And, you know, one of the easy earmarks for that is that it's not secretive or shameful. One of the definitions of sex addiction is any behavior that's secretive, shameful, or abusive to the self or others. So as long as the sex that a person's engaging in is not secretive or shameful, then it's probably fine. So in other words, if you can come home and tell your partner what you did sexually today, or your mother asks you about your weekend, or your best friend, and you're willing to tell them everything you did, including going to a strip club or a prostitute, and they say, that's great, I hope you had a good time, then there's no problem. But the minute you start telling secrets about it, it's likely problematic. Again, healthy sex is not abusive in any way, and this is, we don't think of men abusing themselves sexually, but they do. Men who are sex addicts will objectify themselves, they'll have sex with people they're not really attracted to because they're caught in these patterns. Female sex and love addicts will often have sex with men they really have no interest in having sex with, so they are abusing and hurting themselves. Healthy sex is not used to escape or ignore feelings. Many times, men especially, and women, will talk about using masturbation as a way to manage their anxiety or manage their feelings, and that's a maladaptive coping skill. That's not the purpose of masturbation. And I think that healthy sex requires some kind of emotional connection with another human being. And whether or not that means it's casual sex is up to you, but having no connection, picking up somebody in a bathhouse or a strip club or anonymously in a bar is likely going to be problematic if it's the primary way a person's having sex. I mean, everybody's been in college, everybody's had a one-night stand, everybody's named it as fun or life experience, and that's fine. It's just when it becomes the routine. And addictive sex is actually very routine. What you'll hear is that people are engaging in the same behaviors over and over again in a very routinized way, sometimes reenacting their childhood trauma. It's also shame-based. And there can be levels of dissociation, self-hatred, seeking power and control, which is a big thing for sex addicts. Whereas healthy sex is really deepening a sense of self and is mutually respectful and honoring of the other person. It allows for exploration and making meaning of the sexual act as opposed to just playing the same old note over and over again and kind of reenacting trauma.
Well, yeah, would you say a little bit more about that? Give us an example, because for some of our listeners, they may not know that they're reenacting childhood trauma or family trauma. So
sure.
Give us an example.
Well, sometimes, first of all, there's a mythology that sex addicts have all been sexually abused as children, and that's not the case. And in fact, more often than not, it's not the case. So trauma can come in all sorts of forms. It can come, you know, in the form of an emotional abuse, let's say. So if you have a male who was emotionally abused or denigrated by a mother who, let's say, was mentally ill, let's say she had a mood disorder like bipolar disorder, and that child was either in a state of hyperarousal where he never knew whether he was going to be safe or not, and when it got really bad, he dissociated, then down the road, it's quite possible that he's going to seek pornographic images of women that are doing things that are degrading or humiliating, or he's going to look at images that make him feel degraded or humiliated because that's what he relates to being sexual or being in relationship with a female. He may also choose women that are mentally unstable, emotionally unavailable, and that can also be rageful or humiliating in some ways too. So even though he doesn't see that as an ideal, his nervous system and his brain read that as a template for being relational with somebody.
Right, and because that was the relationship he had with his mother.
Right, and so the opposite sex parent, we have relationships with our opposite sex parent, and that is likely what we will reenact going forward because it's what we know.
Well, that makes sense. Now, somebody who is humiliated as a child, they may be put down, they may be ignored, they may be expected to produce things that are absolutely unavailable to them. Can you think of some other forms of humiliation?
Well, sure. Let's see how far we want to go with that.
Go ahead.
Well, other forms of humiliation would be, a mother who is obsessed with the child's bowel movements until they're much older than appropriate. So typically children start potty training around 2, but if you've got a mother who's checking at 7, at 12, and, you know, is cleaning the child after he has a bowel movement, then that child is going to fuse this distorted notion of being loved and cared for with things that revolve around fecal matter and bowel movements and fecal play, which is a very real fetish. And they're going to seek that out either likely with prostitutes or with online pornography. They're probably not going to tell the person they're dating that that's what they're into. They won't talk about it. They hope it will go away. They may even get married and get into a relationship, but at some point they will start to secretly sneak around and seek that out, which then can cause enormous problems in the relationship because they've never dealt with the trauma of that, because that's a traumatic setup. It's not okay.
Well, and I just recently had a client who was a CEO, and he would spend time putting diapers on and then having bowel movements in public places and enjoying the feeling of that. And it was the exact thing that you talked about. His mother was obsessed with his bowel movements. He was constipated as a child. She would check him constantly, and it set him up to feel that love and attention and also that fear and humiliation, and he was hyper-aroused as a result.
Right, and so now you have, you know, a 40-year-old infant.
Right,
really,
he's a CEO of a company and
right.
has all sorts of responsibilities but has this double life that needs to be met. So
right. So his emotional development has been, you know, truncated, and his erotic intelligence is non-existent.
Yeah. So then oftentimes in recovery, you have to determine what is a healthy sexual fantasy versus an unhealthy, and so you have to get to the root of that, I would assume, and work through in therapy and in group therapy and perhaps even in an intensive inpatient or outpatient unit, how to reverse or rework those kind of issues. So can you share a little bit about what you've done? Because obviously you have the Healthy First, you know, you've got the Center for Healthy Sex. What would you help a client with in this kind of situation?
Well, I think the trajectory that you're mapping out is true. I mean, first want to stop all of the compulsive sexual and destructive behaviors. So in a case like that, having the person stop all the behavior surrounding the public display in the diapers or whatever the behaviors are, it doesn't matter. And having them tolerate the withdrawal symptoms of not having that as a primary coping mechanism and reporting on what those are. And creating a solid recovery program around not acting out sexually on the destructive or problematic behaviors, that's really always the first step. And then starting to look at the underlying issues in the family of origin that set up these erotic templates that are maladaptive templates. because they preclude the person from having an adult relationship, because people, like the one you're describing and the one I'm describing, typically have a tremendous amount of shame around their sexuality. They're avoidant in their attachment styles. They don't know how to connect with other adult people. Their genitals are a place that's either dirty or something to be laughed at or snickered at. And so being able to tolerate eye contact, talking about the most shameful things a person can speak of in relation to other people, as you mentioned in group therapy, is a way to start to mitigate the shame and start to come into a more adult sense of oneself. And then having a partnership where two people can start to engage in healthy sex, and that means, you know, making eye contact during sex, talking to each other, looking at one another's bodies, and slowing down the sexual act so that it's not this rapid-fire, disembodied thing that we see in internet pornography, but really slow and deliberate and a conscious process that allows feelings to come up while the couple are being sexual. That's really the beginning of becoming more sexually sound and not allowing for previous fantasies, previous arousal templates to come into play. That's a later stage process. To be able to integrate role play, fantasy, and, you know, possibly some, you know, kinkier tastes, depending on what the person's history is.
And so many of my clients fear that if they really begin to share some of their fantasies, or even before the fantasy, if they share some of the issues that they've had with their partner will leave them because they'll find them revolting and disgusting. I've never had a partner who has left, but that has clearly been the fear of so many of my clients. How do you help them with that?
Well, by normalizing it. I once had a 34 or 32-year-old man tell me he was about to get married, that he was terrified to tell his fiancé what he liked sexually, that he could only do with prostitutes. And I thought, oh, good Lord, what is he going to tell me? And what he wanted to tell me is that he wanted to have oral sex with her. But he was so afraid of what she would think about that, because he was so ashamed of, you know, desiring that from a woman that he loved and cared for. So sex acts vary between human beings, and there are only so many sex acts, and it's really about the meaning that we give to them. Some people might think sex, you know, oral sex is the most incredible thing on the planet, and other people are going to think it's the most disgusting thing on the planet. It's the same act, it's just the meaning we ascribe to it. So first of all, we have to help people normalize and get rid of the shame they have around their sex and sexuality. That's really one of the number one tasks. And then, you know, getting the partners to talk about their own sexual limitations. You know, why something is a problem for them, and are they pointing the finger at the sex addict and saying, well, you're gross and disgusting, or is it that they themselves have their own sexual issues and fears and concerns, which is more likely the case. Now, again, in early recovery, a partner is going to be enraged and furious, and anything the sex addict says is going to be gross and disgusting. But when you're a year into a process, then it's really incumbent upon both people to look at their sexual fears and limitations. And one of the things erotic intelligence provides for couples is lots of self-reflexive questions about family of origin messages, about sex, values, what they desire their preferred sex life to look like, and various things they can do together to start to construct that.
So as you are compiling your book, you are going to have interviewing questions so that they can find out what are some normal questions that are okay to ask their partner, because, you know, most of our clients have not learned how to talk openly and honestly because of the shame. So you're
right.
Going to have some of those questions available.
Well, those questions are in the book, yes. And I've had couples tell me that just the act of talking about those questions, sometimes at dinner, because the questions are not sexual. They're just more about what are the messages you got about sex and sexuality. Now, some of them later in the book are more sexual, but the initial chapters are not. And I've had people tell me that just the act of talking about those questions with each other was arousing and sexually titillating because they'd never really talked about these things with each other before. So it's a process of building intimacy because eroticism arises out of closeness and intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly that's the foreplay to allow them then to talk about the do's and the don'ts, what they like and what they don't like, if they have
right.
that intimacy.
Yeah, right.
So in your opinion, are sexual fantasies and masturbation, are they healthy sexual behaviors for a recovering addict?
Well, it depends. I have many, many clients who have never been into pornography that much or masturbation. They really wanted sex with live people. So for them, it's not that interesting or that big of a deal. For many who are just engaged in large usage of internet pornography, who may be more avoidant of actual contact with people, pornography is not something they can likely ever look at because it's going to be too triggering for them. For them, the challenge is to be sexual with, a real human being. So, again, it depends on the person and what their history has been with these things. And the same is true with somebody who's has a fetish that they enjoy, whether it's, you know, some light bondage and domination or lingerie usage or something along those lines. As long as both parties are consensual, they're in a conversation about it, what it means. The addict is staying present and not dissociating into past sexual experiences or fantasizing about someone else, then that is going to help people heal their sexuality and lead it more towards the kind of adult sexuality they want to have with each other.
Well, you said light domination and bondage. Is that because heavy-duty bondage and domination would increase disassociation? And
I think it does. I think activating the pain centers is activating trauma most likely. And this is a huge conversation and one we could get a lot of people angry about, but the issue of S&M and whether or not that's a healthy sexual practice or not remains to be seen. I happen to stand on the side of thinking that it's largely trauma reenactment.
And that's why you anger some people, because there are people that believe that it's sexually healthy. Even
right.
though you know that it does activate pain centers, and your experience and research has shown that those people experienced physical trauma.
It's likely so, that there's
uh-huh.
there's something in their background that has led them to this, and they've done it for so long that they couldn't ever really get aroused not doing it. So I guess in my thinking that whenever you're dependent on something and you lose choice, then you're a slave to it. You don't have a choice about whether to do it that way or not. And there's also, again, a rigidity to it.
Sure. That makes total sense. Now, of course, you addressed this a little bit earlier, but if a partner says, I don't like that, I know that that is something that you would absolutely adore, but I don't like that and I don't want to do that, what would you advise a client who said that?
Well, I would investigate with that person what they don't like about it and why, and whether it would have them out of their integrity if they gave it a try, or if it's something that is more of a limitation and they're afraid to experience themselves in that way, because we define ourselves in all sorts of ways and we don't like to see ourselves outside of our comfort zone sometimes. So a simple example of that is, let's say, for the sake of argument and stereotype, that the male is always initiating, the male is the aggressor. And the male complains that, you know, I wish my partner, my wife, my girlfriend would sometimes initiate. I wish sometimes she would take me. I wish she would be on top sometime. And the female says, well, I'm just not comfortable with that. So I'd want to know what the discomfort about that would is? Because is it really taking her out of her integrity or her comfort zone? Does she not want to see herself as someone who's assertive, of someone who actually likes being sexually assertive and has some fun with that? And what would it mean to her to admit that to herself? If she's not the submissive good girl, does that make her a, quote, bad girl? Does it make her distasteful in her own eyes? And is she expecting her partner to live with that limitation, or is she going to stretch herself and grow herself up as an adult woman and experience her sexuality in different ways?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if it does become something maybe more out of the comfort zone, anal sex or S&M, what do you advise for her?
Well, then I think she has to really get clear with herself again with both of those things about what it would cost her to do that, where the line is drawn. And I think we all have different lines for that. I think, you know, for many women, the line is drawn, you know, if they start to feel like they're really being degraded in a way that's devoid of love or connection. Because my experience with most women is that they will go pretty far with their eroticism if they feel loved. Mm-hmm. If they feel loved and cared for and that they trust their partner, then they're pretty much game for just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if they feel unsafe or they're being used or strictly objectified, the answer is going to be no.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, certainly for many women, I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's been a cultural shift. There were certain things that women did not want to partake in 25 years ago that culturally there is more evidence to say that that's a more normal sexual act. So, for instance, oral sex is something that I think women are much more comfortable now than they were 25 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and that's cultural. There's just no doubt about it, with the President of the United States having engaged in that and all sorts of things. Now, do you think that as a culture we are going to move towards more of the unusual sexual acts as we become more sexualized, or do you think that we're going to flip over like a pendulum and maybe even become a little bit more repressed?
No, I think the cat's out of the bag.
Okay.
I think we're in the midst of a massive sexual revolution right now, based on exactly what you're saying. I think women are more sexually liberated and feel more entitled to their sexual pleasure than ever, so much so that it's starting to create problems in relation to gender roles and rules. More and more women are less interested in getting married. They're out-earning men in the workplace. And they don't feel like they really need men other than for sexual satisfaction, because face it, women can have babies without men today. They can have six-figure salaries without men. They don't need men in the way that they used to. And so we've also been extremely influenced by pornography. And pornography opens up with the proverbial cum shot, and it's typically on a woman in some way or another. And that's been the expectation, just as the shift in the fashion and pubic grooming. And so we're being informed by pornography, and we've become very pornographied in our sexual practices. And the problem is people don't know who they are. They don't know what they like. They don't know what feels right for them and what's good for them. So they're either ascribing to some of the mores and values they grew up with, which might have been more rigid and stilted. And on the other side of that is this highly pornographied culture. So we're scrambling right now, both males and females, to figure out who we are, what's okay, and what isn't. And I think those of us that are sex therapists are trying to be the voice of moderation and reason, and saying, you know, let's just have a conversation about it. Have one with your partner. Talk about sex. If you can't talk about it, how can you do it?
Well, right, that's the missing ingredient, is the relational aspect of the sexuality, and that helps to moderate it.
Right, and that's, in my thinking, what takes it out of the pornographic, is that as long as it's relational and consensual between two people, then pretty much anything goes. But when it's not relational, it really becomes pornographic.
Okay, so then what do couples do when they have varying sexual desires? I heard you say that they should talk about it. that they should investigate and inquire into their own discomfort and what's that about, so that they look at themselves. Anything else?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon for one person to be high desire and one person to be low desire. So people, again, are going to have to find ways to be sexual that doesn't necessarily include intercourse, to talk about their level of satisfaction, what they need to do to take care of themselves. Because it's often news to people that they're responsible for their own orgasms and their own sexual pleasure. It's not your partner's job. You have to be a grown-up and tell your partner exactly what you need and what you want and how often. And if you are a sex addict, you've got to question yourself about the frequency and, you know, are you acting out within your relationship, or is this really viably that you're desiring your partner? And if you're desiring your partner, what are the different things the two of you can do that's not always recruiting intercourse?
Well, and so if somebody is in relationship with someone else, but they've chosen to be sexually anorexic, and when I see patients like this, oftentimes there's another agenda. Maybe they're afraid of performing because they've had difficulty in relational sex. It's not the same. Their brain continues to have trouble with that. What would you advise?
Well, I think the person who's sexually anorexic should be in treatment because, you know, as you know, this is another form of power and control. Typically, the low-desire partner is controlling the relationship. And when I'm saying low-desire, I'm talking about sexual anorexia, not somebody who's just not in the mood tonight.
Right.
Because when you think about the position of low-desire, the person who has low desire in any interaction in a relationship controls the relationship. So if, for example, you and I are in a partnership, Carol, and I want to buy a car and you don't, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
We're not buying a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to have sex and you don't, we're not having sex. And so these are positions in the system. And those have to be talked about and worked out. And typically, if it's a sexual anorexia situation, then you're going to need a professional.
Mm-hmm. And then if that person is alone for right now, maybe they've broken up with their partner and they're sexually anorexic. Obviously, again, it's power and control because it's protecting them from their own self and from the possibility of getting hurt in a relationship. Any
right.
books you would advise, any direction you would expect a single person to go?
I mean, the best book on sexual anorexia is a book called Sexual Anorexia by Dr. Patrick Carnes. And for people who are truly sexually anorexic, not those who are going through a period of celibacy, you really need to look at deprivation issues. And also, you know, the fear and pain of being you know, jilted in a relationship, and how to heal that so that you can change, grow, and get stronger over time. It's not the end of the world. And sexuality should be a joyous experience. It should be filled with laughter and fun and play states. It shouldn't be a dour, shame-based, painful thing that people have to endure. So if it's not fun, if you're not having a good time doing it, if it doesn't feel celebratory, then you really have to look at where the impediments are for you, where are the blockades, what's holding you back from your potential.
Well, that's a great answer. So you feel that Dr. Carnes' book is probably the best on the market in terms of sexual anorexia. Last but not least, will you just give us a brief overview of what the difference is between healthy sex, intimate sex, erotic sex, and spiritual sex?
Well, healthy sex, as I said before, is comprised of not being secretive, shameful, or abusive. It's not used to escape feelings. It has an emotional connection. It's about love, respect, and mutual caring. Intimate sex goes a little bit deeper in that it really calls upon people to give and receive with one another, and in terms of being more authentic and really being willing to be uncomfortable in order to grow sexually.
Right,
so
vulnerable.
You're saying, yeah, being present with your feelings, you know, with your body, how you feel about your body. So really cracking open into this place of saying yes, being honoring, stepping out of your comfort zone. So getting in a little bit deeper with your partner is what the, where the intimate process starts to occur. Erotic sex starts to bring in passion and imagination, you know, more flirtation and planning and engaging in various rituals.
Pleasure and play, so to speak.
Sure, and it's, you know, these, each one of these steps sort of transcend and include the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But you're engaging with your partner very deeply. You're no longer hiding out and fantasizing about other people. You're fully present to them, and you can go so far as to really enjoy your partner watching you have pleasure and enjoy the pleasure of watching you have, you know, watching them watch you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an open-hearted state. And then spiritual sex, I think, is different for everybody, but it's a real recognition that you are, you know, gazing into your partner's eyes and meeting the divine, whatever that means to you, that you're synchronizing your breath, that it's no longer about the end point of orgasm or getting off, but a sense of wanting to connect deeply to your own self, to a third power or energy that's being created by the two of you. And that can be, and many of the great sexual teachings talk about sexuality being the high road to God or spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just reminded me of tantric sex, and that,
sure,
that is certainly part of the process. So if people want to find out more about your book or find out more about your healing center, just let us know a little bit about that. How can they,
sure,
do that, and the center, what's that all about?
Well, the centerforhealthysex.com is an organization that I founded whereby we treat all aspects of sexuality, from sexual addiction to issues of sexual desire and dysfunction. For sex addicts, we offer an 11-day intensive outpatient program where we really work on the denial and relapse prevention and start to talk about some of these matters we've been talking about today. We include the partner in that. If you live in the Los Angeles area, we offer sex addiction treatment groups for men. We have a women's intimacy group for women that struggle with sex and love issues, and we have a partners group for partners of sex addicts. So we have day patient or you know, regular outpatient services and this intensive outpatient program for both males and females who are sex addicts. And then Erotic Intelligence can be purchased at my website, thecenterforhealthysex.com, or on amazon.com.
Okay. And well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. And I would advise anybody to buy Alex's book, because obviously anyone can use that. Would you say it's for addicts, or would you say it's for the general public?
Well, I think the tenets in the book hold up for the general public.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if you're in recovery from drugs or alcohol or sex addiction, this book is enormously helpful for all people in recovery, you know, even for alcoholics, because they get sober from, you know, chemicals, and then they start acting out sexually, or a relationship will derail their chemical sobriety. So it's really good for all people in recovery.
Well, Alex, thank you so much, and I'm going to get the book tomorrow.
Good.
I appreciate it, and you've been wonderful. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carol. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. So, as you can see, that's an amazing book that obviously will take us to the next level when it comes to developing the kind of healthy sex that works into very clearly kind of intimate sex, erotic sex. I mean, I'm sure you all can imagine that it's important to be able to seek pleasure for pleasure itself, but within the context of a meaningful relationship. And last but not least, that's spiritual sex. I suspect that that's a really tough area for a lot of people to get into. And so Alex's book will help to take you to that next level by having you look at your own issues and the self-care that you need and all the skills necessary to form healthy sexuality. So we will be seeing you next week. Look forward to interviewing some more informative and wise people on talking about sexuality, sexual addiction, and sexual recovery. Now, remember, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and we'll see you next week, 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, on Sex Help with Carol the Coach.